Good afternoon. Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Mental illness is surrounded by multiple myths. Nevertheless, its effects can echo through multiple generations as well. Today, we're going to be discussing mental illness, and we're going to be using the platform of a new documentary film called The Faces of Gwendolyn Bradshaw to do that. My guests are documentary filmmaker Mary Kotsky. She's the founder of Affinity Films, which addresses social issues and tries to instigate some change. And also Anchorage School psychologist Deb Ward, who is a board member of Affinity Films. If you want to reach us today, you can call us at 550-8433. Our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you
for having us.
Great to have both of you back. We've done this before, and I think this is a very, very interesting topic and story. Mary, you want to tell us a little bit more about Affinity Films, and then maybe we can get into the story?
Sure. Affinity Films is now 30 years old. We've been creating social issues media right here in Alaska for all that time. We've covered many topics over the years, from breast cancer to illiteracy, to homelessness, domestic violence, and this particular film is looking at mental illness through the vehicle of a very powerful heroine named Gwendolyn Bradshaw. And by the way, the name of the film is About Face, the story of Gwendolyn Bradshaw,
okay.
Yes.
All right.
So we pride ourselves in existing on our grants and donations and producing meaningful media.
All right. So let's talk about an overview, if you would, of the movie or the documentary, so that we can get an idea of all the issues that are brought up, and then we can maybe one by one slug through some of these issues that are brought up.
About Face follows a young woman, an Alaskan woman, who was tragically injured as a child when her mentally distraught mother put her in a fire at the age of 10 months old. The story picks up when Gwen is 24 and has been out on her own for a few years and has crashed herself. And when she's brought into API, the intake officer recognizes her name and tells her that he is the same person who intook her mother the night of the incident. And something clicked for Gwen in terms of her knowing that she didn't want to perpetuate this cycle. And she took a very brave step by calling me and saying she wanted to tell her story and hopes that she would resolve many of her questions for herself and maybe help other people in the process. I should backtrack just a bit to say that I've known Gwen since she was 3 years old. She grew up next door to me, so it wasn't just out of the blue that she called, and it wasn't out of the blue that she had an idea for a film. She'd been on many film shoots while she was growing up, and she knew the process. But she had never been interested in being in front of the camera before, so I was very intrigued by that. And our first interview happened the day that she was released from API, and it took us 5 years to get to what we felt was a natural conclusion to her journey, which in her mind meant that she needed to find her mother.
Do you think Gwendolyn understood at the beginning that there would be somewhat of a catharsis or a helping of her work out some of the issues with the film? Did she have that kind of foresight, or was she really looking to educate others about what was going on?
You know, I don't think either one of us really knew where the journey would take us.
Mm-hmm.
But there was enough trust there from knowing each other to take a chance. I mean, there were many times in the 5 years where I thought, well, is this ever going to be over? Are we ever going to feel like we're done? Because there were many times, many turning points. For instance, when she found out she had a sister and they met and she had this new relationship in her life. Or when she found out that her mother had disappeared and the last person who knew her had no idea where she was for the past year. There were points where we could have said, well, maybe that's the end of the story. But it didn't feel finished until she actually found her mother.
What were the physical consequences of the burn injury?
Well, Gwen has is missing an ear and some fingers and has scarring over a large proportion of her body and her scalp. So it's pretty dramatic, although she's a beautiful woman, and she has the artistic ability to work around that and come across as a very lovely woman.
Deb, I like to think about the fact that when I do this program that I'm trying to educate people. Now, maybe that's ridiculous, but that's the purpose here. And what I've learned after doing this for 10 years is I've learned a hell of a lot more than everybody else probably has. So I like to ask people that have been involved in something like this, what'd you learn?
Well, I've learned a lot about filmmaking since I knew nothing about it. I learned that it's so much more involved than you can imagine just by sitting in a theater and looking at a film. And I met a wonderful, inspiring woman when I met Gwen. She is one of the most courageous people I've ever met. I feel very honored that she is sharing her story with all of us through the film. I learned about how the power of just one person reaching out to provide support, as Mary did when she was little, made a big difference in Gwen's life. And I learned how much persistence and determination can take a person, how far it can take a person. And that Gwen's own inner strength and her spirit has really moved her forward.
Mary, same question.
Well, that's a great question. I remember writing a couple of letters to the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority as we were producing this film, saying, I thought it would be done in a year, but it looks like it's going to take a little bit longer, and then writing another one and saying, I am really learning a lot about mental illness. It's not something that just goes away or gets fixed really quickly. There's many layers. There's many causes. And so for me, as with every topic we take on, there's a big learning curve, just exactly the illness or the issue or the matter that we're taking on. So I had to learn patience. I also learned the power of having a good 5-minute trailer when you're out fundraising. I didn't know that before, but it was just this little 5-minute piece that we created in the beginning, thanks to the Arts Council. We were able to raise 50% of our funding with that. And then once we had half the film shot and edited, we were able to get the last part really quickly. So there was a building process, starting with a very little piece and moving up until we finally had enough to actually go to New York and L.A. and finish the film on a national caliber level.
What do you hope to accomplish, or what do you hope you have accomplished, or you're still trying to accomplish, because this documentary is being shown around the country and around the world, actually, you were saying. And
well, it's interesting, a couple of things. Every time that it's been shown, and it's been shown in Korea and Canada, and people come up from the audience and tell me about living with a mentally ill parent. I didn't realize so many people had that on a close personal level. Apparently, was it 24% or 26% of people in the United States have at one point in their life a diagnosable mental illness. So I didn't know that it was so prevalent. I also see how moving it is for someone to travel with Gwen on this journey and to actually feel and be inside the life of somebody who's struggling and working hard to overcome mental illness. How powerful that can be. It's one thing to read about it in a book, but it's another to be there with her during those steps. And she holds nothing back. There's nothing between you, the film, and the audience. She didn't put up any barriers. The camera was pretty much invisible most of the time.
Why did her mother throw her in the fire?
Well,
you want to talk about postpartum psychosis?
Yeah. Gwen's mother had mental health issues prior to her pregnancy, and we really don't know a lot about it because it's all anecdotal. The information we have is given mainly from Gwen's father, but she was diagnosed with postpartum psychosis, which is a severe form of mood disorder that occurs after pregnancy. And she reported having hallucinations, and there's also a possibility of substance abuse that compounds the issue. Mm-hmm. But she was not receiving treatment during her period of depression and postpartum depression and psychosis. So part of the message for this film is it's so important to get the help you need, and that by doing so, you can avoid severe consequences.
How common is postpartum mood disorder?
Well, the postpartum psychosis is extremely rare. It is the rarest form, although I think television really is – that's the one that gets the TV kind
sure.
of
– Sure. Makes you think it's more common than it is.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It is – I have a statistic here somewhere, and I can find that for you. But it is rare. We do we have – in our guide, we do have a – an expert that has written about it. Approximately one out of every eight, or about 12% of women, experience significant depression. Mm-hmm. But as far as postpartum psychosis, it occurs in about 1 or 2 per 1,000 births. So it is not very common.
Mm-hmm. So this is the kind of thing is thought to happen. There was several years ago, there was a woman who killed a couple of her children in Texas. I can't remember the situation, but I had been asked to discuss that on the program. We discussed postpartum depression. I don't know that we've ever really discussed the more severe mood things like psychosis. What's the difference between just a depression and a psychosis then from a easy-to-understand listener standpoint?
Well, with the psychosis, there are psychotic features, which would be delusions and hallucinations and that type of severity. Depression is more could be more of a mood or anxiety problem. People with a family history or personal history of bipolar disorder or other psychotic disorders are certainly more at risk for developing, you know, a full-blown postpartum psychosis. So that's why it's very important for a woman to talk with her healthcare provider about it, and for the physician who's taking care of her as a mother or during her prenatal checks to know about her mental health. And on the other hand, often women don't share that because women with mental illness are at very high risk of not being able to keep their children because of the
So they have another reason besides just the ones we all have is we don't want to – there's a stigma about discussing mental illness.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Yes.
Is there evidence that Gwendolyn's mother had significant psychological problems before the pregnancy?
Well
– What I'm getting at is it – I don't want people to think that just – having a baby is necessarily
the trigger
of this kind of thing.
And she still has problems.
Often
yes.
There is pre-existing things that may be brought out more by the stresses and complications of delivery.
And it's not to say that someone who suffers from depression can't have a baby.
Right.
It's to say that it needs to be mentioned to your care provider so they can help you work with it.
Right.
And she still has mental health issues, but she has not, to our knowledge anyway, hurt another person again since that time when she was in postpartum.
So part of psychosis, to help people understand, is really they lose appropriate perception of reality, and they may not be aware of what they're doing when they hurt somebody else.
It's not.
It may be purposeful, but it's working from a poor understanding of reality at the time. So we need to understand that's what's happening. They may think they're doing something good, for example, when they do that.
Right.
And Mary is the name of her mother, was exhibiting signs of being in trouble the night that it happened. And as Gwen's father, Joe, says in the film, she was like going into trances and he couldn't get her out without yelling at her. But he thought something was wrong, but it wasn't something you could see or put your finger on. And he was afraid if he took her to a hospital that he'd be made fun of because it wasn't something that you could see. And we're hoping that by seeing this story, people will know to trust that intuition when they feel like somebody might be in trouble. To not just ignore it or be afraid that it won't be recognized, because there's a good chance something is wrong.
So that gets to one of the, in a sense, a myth or a misperception that we just culturally have not gotten to the point where we can accept and understand the various mental illnesses as a true disease, much like diabetes or arthritis or influenza.
Exactly.
That it's not some weakness in the person.
Is exactly. That right? Exactly. And that's where the stigma comes from. If only, you know, this person would snap out of it or stop feeling sorry for themselves, they'd be okay. And we just need to be tough love and give them tough love and they'll snap out of it. And that's not understanding that it is an actual illness that can be treated.
And in Mary's case, her husband felt that taking her camping that night would make everything better. And that's the night that the incident mm-hmm. happened.
And off the top of my head, that doesn't seem like an unreasonable suggestion.
Right.
To get away from stress, get away from anxiety, get up to nature. I mean, sounds good to me.
If you're not coping with a serious mental health issue, then it probably is a very good strategy kind of just take a break. In Mary's case, she had this pre-existing mental health concern, may or may not have been using substances to cope with it, mm-hmm. Was described as being extremely quiet and silent and non-responsive. And in that case, mm-hmm. that was a sign that she probably needed more help.
Reminder, listeners, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guests today are Mary Kotsky and Deb Ward. We're talking about the film, The About Face, the story of Gwendolyn Bradshaw. And her story, which is a story of mental health, and I've said how it echoes through generations. Maybe that's not the correct way, but I think it is very important to think about the multi-generational effects of mental health, and that's one of the things we're discussing. So if you've got questions at all, give us a call, 550-8433 is our local number. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us at lineone, lineone, all one word, at kska.org. Deb, what do we know about the genetics or the hereditary tendency of significant mental illnesses to run through families? And in a kind of a corollary question, what do we know about children who are raised in families where there are significant mental health issues?
Well, there is a lot of research being done currently about looking at genetics and trying to find genetic markers for mm-hmm. mental illness. There is definitely indicators that it does, that it is, there is an inheritability to it. As, for example, 25% of the children that have a parent that's diagnosed with bipolar may, in fact, have a bipolar disorder themselves. But there's also the environmental component. So mm-hmm. there's a predisposition toward the mental illness, with environmental factors being very important, and whether that is manifested. And as far as having a parent that has mental illness, having a mental illness does not mean that a parent will not be able to be a good parent. It doesn't preclude them from being a good parent. There are some studies that show that children may be more at risk for developmental delays, academic delays, but there's some complications with the studies, because oftentimes kids are not raised by their parent because of the fact that many children are taken from the homes. And there are also many children that are very resilient, and they do form attachments with maybe their other parent or another significant adult. One of the things that I thought was interesting when I was doing some research in this area is that children's challenging behaviors can actually – there's kind of an interplay. When a child has a challenging behavior, that could actually stress out the parent more. And so anyone who is a parent knows that challenging behaviors can be very, very stressful. There's a project that I'd like to mention called the Invisible Children's Project. It's a nationally recognized program for parents with mental illness, and it provides home-based, family-focused interventions that looks at the family as the unit of service versus the parent. And they've had really good results with providing parent education and other kinds of parent support to the parents, and had very good outcomes.
Yeah. That's an interesting way to look at it. I hadn't quite thought about it, that I would think if you had a parent with significant mental illness, there'd be some increased risk. But the point is, it's the whole family. And actually, it's more of the social milieu. It may be grandparents. It may be neighbors. Mm-hmm. It may be so that there's a lot of factors that come into play. And we want to come back to Gwendolyn's part to play and how she's had such a hard row, but a very amazing outcome, which gets back to her resilience, which we want to discuss. I do have a call, and I want to take Robert right now, and let's see what he has to ask. Robert, you're on line one.
Hi. I have a couple of disparate questions, and if your guest has time, I'd like to ask both of them. The one that occurred to me more recently when I heard you talk about the 23% of Americans have mental illness. I assume that means people who are being treated with prescription psychotropic drugs, as I am. And that's for depression. And I think many of that 23% are depressed people who are prescribing, and they say they overprescribe medication for depression, and I suppose that's a mental illness, but it's not of the kind that would cause me to throw someone in the fire.
Okay. I'm not sure I got the point you want to make. I mean, I think the 23% to me, and I'll ask Mary to elaborate if she can, but I think that brings into the whole gamut of everything from psychoses to anxiety to depression. So it's a large gap, not all of which, and perhaps even only a minority, I don't know the answer to this, would be necessarily on medication.
And at some point in their life.
So it's not this is not a point. It's throughout the life.
Okay. Well, it's a meaningless statistic. I think it's a statistic on the side of the angels, because people ought to be much more aware of and forthcoming about their emotional and mental problems so that they can be properly treated.
Right.
And I'm certainly a happier person since I got on serotonin uptake inhibitors. My other question was she said that she made half the film, and when she had done that, she was able to get funding more easily for the second half. And my impression was that films were not filmed in the order that the viewer sees them at the end. And therefore, I wonder if she made her film from beginning to end, or if she meant she just had enough film for half of a documentary.
Well, I tell you what, I happen to know the documentary filmmaker, so let's ask her.
Well, you're absolutely right. Films are not always finished in the sequence that they were filmed. However, documentaries tend to be more linear than fiction, dramatic film shooting. And in answer to your question, we actually only had half the film. We had not found her mother yet when we got our last dose of funding. We had only gotten up through where she had gone to Indiana, and she had met her mother's last 7-year boyfriend, a relationship that had lasted 7 years. She had met him, and he had said that she had disappeared on Valentine's Day when he had gone to City Hall to get a marriage license. And that's as far as we got. But that was a great cliffhanger I'm speaking strictly from a filmmaking standpoint and fundraising standpoint. Yeah. It was a wonderful half story to bring to people because it made you want to know the rest.
Mm-hmm.
So the film was made pretty much in chronological order and in real time, I guess, at least.
Absolutely.
Half point on.
Yep.
Yes, it was.
Robert, I'd like to say thank you for bringing the point up about people being able to talk about their depression or their mental illness, and that is exactly the point of this film, that we want people to realize that it is part of the human journey. And some people, unfortunately, have a severe form of mental illness that can end in serious consequences, and we just don't want tragedies to happen again, and that's why we want people to feel that it shouldn't be a stigma.
Yes, and of course, I felt very ashamed when I was first diagnosed with depression, which is at a young age. And if there had been medication for it then, or effective medication, I probably would have been ashamed to take it. But but my life would have been considerably happier, I think, if I'd had at least today's medication earlier in life.
Yep. Thanks for your call.
Yep.
Appreciate it. Rick, you're on line one.
Did you say Rick?
Yeah.
Hi. Hey, thanks. I'm listening, enjoying the topic, and this may have already been covered. I just want to throw this out there. You know, I think a lot of times people hear, for example, in a line one program, they might, you know, hear that a topic is about mental health, illness, whatever, and I think people tend to tune out. Excuse the sound in the background. I think sometimes people tend to tune out things about mental illnesses or health because they think, oh, that doesn't apply to me. But, you know, the fact is that we all experience mental health and mental illness just in the roller coaster of our status, our happiness versus our sadness. Those are all status, the statuses regarding our mental health. And so, I want listeners who might be on the edge or catch this in the evening program and start to tune it out to just remember that it's important to remember we all have issues of mental health and I think to tag on to that, it's really important to learn how to move on and not get caught up in the quagmire of our depressions, our sadnesses, but to learn tools and skills to lift us beyond that so that we can get to a state of better health. And that's really about all I had to say.
Well, I appreciate the editorialization. I think you're right on. We appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks, Bye.
Thank
all right.
You.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. In Anchorage, you can reach us at 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us at line1@kska.org. After this brief break, we'll continue to take your calls and emails and talk with Mary Kotsky and Deb Ward on Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen to Line 1, Your Health Connection again, tune in tonight at 8. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking telephone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, Line 1 will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
This is Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Welcome back. Today we're speaking with documentary filmmaker Mary Kotsky and Anchorage School psychologist Deb Ward about mental illness and Mary's film about FACE, the story of Gwendolyn Bradshaw. If you've got questions, you can call us at 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and you can email at line1@kska.org. Please also remember that if you're listening between 8 and 9, you're listening to a rebroadcast of a previously recorded version of the program, and we won't be taking phone calls or answering your emails at that time. I do want to echo what our last caller, Rick, had to say with two comments. One, I found a comment somewhere, and I put it in a couple of my exam rooms, and it said, "No family can say there's no problem here." And I put that in my exam room so that I wouldn't hopefully have people recognize that it's okay that things don't work out perfectly all the time in everybody's family, because all of us have some problems at some time, and I'm encouraging people to talk about it. The other comment I would make is that when well-done studies have looked at what happens in primary care offices, and this is the relationship between psychosocial and psychological issues in healthcare, is that about one-third of the patients who come into a primary care physician have purely medical problems. They broke their bone, they had a heart attack, something like that. But about a third, the same number, come in and have no regular health problem. Their problem is psychosocial, psychological, depression, anxiety, and so forth. And then the other third, surprisingly, have a medical problem, but the main reason they're in the healthcare system is the psychosocial issues related to the healthcare system, to their health disorder. The anxiety that has brought on the feeling that they're having a heart attack and so forth, or the difficulty in being able to pay for medications and so forth. So that the psychosocial and societal issues related to healthcare are a huge part of what goes on in primary care. So that's my soapbox, but it's just to remind people that this is a very common problem. I think we have made some headway culturally in accepting it, but the point of the film, which is a good one, is we got a long way to go. You agree, Mary?
I think it's true. It's going to be small steps, or can be small steps. When a friend comes to you and tries to tell you that they're feeling blue, let's say depression, and they just can't seem to get up on it. Instead of saying, oh, you'll be fine, or, oh, you know, that'll pass. Instead of doing that, say, well, let's talk about that. How might we address that? Where might we go to get some help? Instead of joining this denial situation, I think also when you have a neighbor with children and their behavior is strange and you're wondering if the children are safe, please take that step. Please reach out. There are so many resources out there, but it does take advocacy. And unfortunately, when somebody's suffering from mental illness, they might not feel strong enough to go and get that help. So if you can advocate for someone, I think it's a good thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are all part of a community, and Gwen's an example of growing up in a community where she got she didn't get a lot of the help she needed in mm-hmm. some critical times in her mm-hmm. growing up years, but she's also gotten surprising amount of outreach in her adult years. And I know when the article about the story ran last April, there were over, I think, 100 responses posted, and people remembered everything from when she was in grade school to somebody even came out of the woodwork who was at the campground the night that it happened. It's very interesting how many times there was an opportunity for someone to step in and maybe just give just that little boost, that little push, the eye, the witness, to stop something from happening.
Deb, can people who want to see this film somehow arrange to see it in the near future?
Well, if they want to go to Greece, they can see it next week, because the film has been selected to be in a film festival in Greece. Uh-huh. But in Anchorage, there will be a early childhood mental health conference at the end of May, from May 25th to the 27th. And there will be a screening of the film at that time with a panel discussion following.
And also, we will be doing a statewide tour, courtesy of the Mental Health Trust, the trust as they prefer. Mm-hmm. And we have not secured all of our communities. So if there are communities out there listening who would be interested in hosting a screening, mm-hmm. We're able to bring either Gwen and myself, or Deb and myself, or Deb and Gwen. Two of us can go to each screening, and we'll be showing the film, and we will also have our discussion guide finished at that time. Right now it's with the graphic designer. It's already been written. And we think it's going to be a wonderful, comprehensive 60-page tool to use the film in educational settings, from upper level of high school through college through professional enhancement training.
People who might be interested in having the film at their community can link on to our website, or go to our website, ksk.org/line1, and you can link to Affinity Films, but also I bet you have a phone number that people might be willing to be interested in calling.
Well, we could – I think email is probably the best way, okay, since I'll be on the road. But you can email us off the Affinity Films website, but also the film itself has a dedicated website, which is actually quite nice. It's aboutfacefilm.org. aboutfacefilm.org, and you can email us right off there.
And we are linked to that website off our website as well. All right, we have another caller. Thomas, you're on line one.
I just wanted to comment. I'm in the VA's wellness program with Dr. Madden, and the medication that they gave me is like ibuprofen. I don't feel it, so I quit taking it, and I got depressed again. So it works really good. I don't feel it working, but I'm happy mm-hmm. when I take it. And then my other secret is to get well. I'm old school. I spin the Rolodex with all kinds of problems, and the key is to have a Rolodex card on your forehead that says, well, I'm well.
Mm-hmm.
And just keep reinstating that, and you will be well.
Yeah, Rick, I think your point about sometimes you don't recognize with these kinds of problems, and even with physical problems. I have patients who are on preventative medications with asthma, and they do well. So the question is, do I still need that medication? And sometimes you got to stop it to realize it was doing something. So I don't think that that observation is unreasonable, and I think it's a good one. So we appreciate you letting us know about that.
Yeah, take our medication, and don't be afraid to try medication.
And stay positive, too. You talked about staying positive.
All right. Thanks for your call, Thomas. Let's get back to Gwendolyn. We've left her, and she's the hero. We haven't really fleshed out how remarkable I think this woman is. And Deb, either one of you, but last week we used the term resilience when we were talking about some issues with the child psychologist, and I can think of no better term than to describe Gwendolyn. Now, would you agree, and why?
Well, I agree that she is incredibly she's resilient. She faced challenges that are really unimaginable to most of us. That resilience really is continuing to occur. Gwen continues to be resilient. She's finishing her degree in music with an emphasis in music education. She's writing a book. She's continuing to see her friends and have a good social life. I think some of the factors that influence Gwen's resilience are her intelligence and creativity, her persistent temperament, and then, of course, having someone, an adult in her life that really looked out for her. She had her dad that stayed with her. Mary was involved with her and did a lot of activities with her when she was growing up. Gwen plays violin. She had her violin lessons, which were another important, those lessons really were another connection for her.
Mm-hmm.
There were some negative influences that she had to overcome, bullying being one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Kids were bullying her because of her physical.
Yeah, the way she looked.
And yes.
So she was ostracized because of the injuries.
Picked on.
Okay.
Yeah, she was teased.
And which brings up the whole issue of bullying, which has been importantly been addressed now in a lot of school districts around the world. It's important. But so just to flesh out a little bit why some of the issues she's had to deal with better. Okay.
Right. And I do think that things have changed since Gwen was in school. There is much more head-on approach to dealing with bullies from the Resolving Conflict Creatively program in the Anchorage School District that they start in elementary school. They have an aggressors, victims, bystanders program in the middle school. And I think that adults also have to check their attitudes about bullying. A lot of adults say, oh, it'll toughen them up. And they see it as kind of a rite of passage for kids. And, certainly we have to have a sense of humor about ourselves, but bullying is repeated harassment, and that is not good for kids.
We're off the subject a little bit, but why would teaching kids about bullying and the effects of bullying be perhaps much more effective in schools, school-age kids, than in adults? Or am I wrong about that?
Well, I think they're forming their social relationships at that time. Kids often report that that's where bullying happens, out on the mm-hmm. playground mm-hmm. in non-supervised areas. And it's kind of a good place to get a group of kids together to teach a lesson. I mean, it sounds mm-hmm. I mean, it's certainly important to do at home, and they absolutely follow mm-hmm. the models of their parents. If there are parents that are bullies, then likelihood that kids will see that as an okay behavior is pretty high. But as far as learning about maybe some empathy and what is it like to stand in the shoes of a victim, schools can be a good place to teach that.
So she found her mother, and what happened then?
Well, finding her mom was pretty exciting because we had given up, and we thought there's one last thing we could try, and that was to put a personals ad in the newspaper where she was last seen. And she didn't respond to that, but a retired detective did. And she said that she wanted to stay anonymous, but that her heart went out to this young woman trying to find her mother, and she understood the importance of that, and she was willing to volunteer to try to see what she could do. And she, lo and behold, found evidence that she was living in Burlington, Vermont. And she told us that since she was likely on Social Security, that it would be good to plan our trip around the first of the month when people on Social Security tend to cash their checks. So we took a complete chance and got 4 airplane tickets so my crew could meet us there, and we flew out. And we found her mother in a magical 4-hour window between when she got out of a mental hospital and got onto a bus for parts unknown. 4 hours, and we found her. And we just, I mean, it'll make a believer out of you if you ever think about mm-hmm. divine intervention, because we felt it. We were mm-hmm. just ecstatic, and to have it all on film. And then, I don't want to spoil the film for anyone, but the 36 hours we spent with her mother, everything you could imagine happening would happen. Everything from, you know, the laughter, the shared childhood memories, the forgiving exchange, the mother-daughter moments of getting Christmas treats for each other, to the full circle of her mother's medications wearing off, and her descending back into her mental illness, which needs treatment, but she doesn't like to take her drugs, which is why mm-hmm. she lives on the streets. Mm-hmm. So Gwen got to see everything and got to go through that personal catharsis with her mom. And then when her mom got on a bus and left to parts unknown again, she had her answers. It wasn't a fairy tale ending, but she had her answers, which was better than not knowing.
So here's a girl who is born into a family where the mother has a significant psychotic break after delivery, throws her into a fire, disfigures her. She has problems in school related to that disfigurement, struggles with that loss of family, loss of her own image, loss of the family, loss of support. Wants to meet her mother, meets her mother. Wasn't such a good thing in the end. And yet she's interested in having her story told. That's resilience.
Yes.
I mean, I'm not sure I touched on all of the problems. I may not know all the problems, well, but that's a remarkable person in my book.
She's a remarkable person. I think being able to see her mother do this pattern and not treat her illness and live the life she's living with garbage bags to hold her clothing, Gwen got some resolve from that too, that she did not want to manage her life in the same way that her mother mm-hmm. had. And mm-hmm. She started off by finding everything they had in common. They both loved music, you know, they looked alike, and so she ended with, I'm different than my mom because I can feel empathy, because I have a home, because I have a goal, I have a career, I have relationships that go on, not just transient in homeless shelters. So, I mean, it's impossible to see this story and not feel empowered in some way.
Mm-hmm. And yet she had problems. I mean, it wasn't...
No, it wasn't easy.
It wasn't easy.
It's not... It's never really easy or over in a way. Uh-huh. But, you know, making steps. I mean, the first tendency for a lot of people with mental illness is to self-medicate with illegal drugs. And she went through that phase herself. And our justice system is to punish. It's not to fix. So they catch you doing something like that, and they punish you. They don't try to see why you're doing it and help you get over it or find a better path. So she went through a lot of different steps along the way of finding her bearing, of getting her sea legs with life.
Well, the issue of the intersection of mental health and the criminal justice system is an important one, and perhaps we'll can get back to it. I don't want to give it short shrift, but there's an email here and another caller I think are important. This is a woman who is emailed, who's 54. She says, I have a serious mental illness, borderline personality disorder. I've struggled with since late adolescence. I'm now 54. However, I'm a very high-functioning person, married, have a career I love and in which I excel. However, she still works very hard with therapy. And her comment is, I feel like I should be more, quote, out, end quote, about my mental health problems to show that mentally ill individuals are everywhere and to help end the stigma. But I'm very careful to get to know someone before I share this issue with them. I'm always... get the comment, but you seem so normal. So she's partly saying she wishes she could be more out there helping people understand, and yet she's worried about how she's still going to be accepted.
I would encourage her to write anonymously. I mean, we need to hear that.
Yeah.
And I understand also why she wants to protect herself. If she's in a career that she loves, she doesn't want to jeopardize that. But I hope that she will speak out. I hope that she'll write about it.
And I think there are other, you know, there are other ways to support the community by just being kind to people who may have mental health challenges, maybe being involved with... groups that support children who have significant issues. And I think just being, you know, I want to commend the writer for making sure that she's doing a good job with her job, finding a good job, sticking with it, staying in therapy, doing all those things that make her a good citizen and a good neighbor. And
okay. We have another caller. Chris, you're on line one.
Thank you for taking my call. I just have a question about a condition that was mentioned by the person who actually sent in the email. And uh-huh. It's I've learned about borderline personality disorder recently, and that was quite an awakening because I have a loved one that I believe this applies to, and I'm curious as to... First, how do you, you know, approach the person with this kind of thing and to talk to them about it? And also, what kinds of therapies are there available for this kind of disorder?
Okay.
I don't feel that I can really give you a lot of information about that. In terms of the kinds of therapies, it would be best to... maybe contact NAMI, the National Association of Mental Health Organization, and they would have information. I'm sorry, it's the National Alliance on Mental Health. They may have more information about it, but I think it is really it is difficult to talk with family members about behaviors you're observing. I think one of the best things you can do is be supportive, be a good listener. Maybe gently talk with them about things that are of concern.
The NAMI website is also linked on our website. And if you go there, there will be people you can contact and there will be good suggestions about how you might talk with people you're involved with or in your family that about how to address these issues. But I would encourage you to learn about this illness and then perhaps move on to the next stage if you think it's if it's real, and talk to the individual or the family a little bit more about it.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right. So back to the intersection of the criminal justice system. Why would people with mental health issues intersect with the criminal justice system first? And then what's the likely consequence of that intersection? And is that good?
Well, I think that, you know, over the last 30 years, there has been a marked increase in persons with mental illness becoming involved with the criminal justice system. At this point, more than half of the prison and jail inmates have some type of mental illness. And in Alaska, it's about 40% of the population that has that are mental health trust beneficiaries. So there's a very big overlap. And part of that is when beds were not available any longer for individuals with mental health issues, and there was a deinstitutionalization going on, people ended up on the street, which is a really hard place to live, and the rate of criminal activity increased. So rather than having communities actually find solutions and take care of the needs of the mental health individuals' mental health issues, they became more involved with the criminal justice system.
And Mary, you'd alluded to sometimes that intersection is not always the most beneficial for the person.
I've even had that experience in my own family, tragically, this winter. And clearly, the person needed help, but what he got was punishment. Mm-hmm. And I think that, unfortunately, we're set up to view antisocial behavior as something that should be punished rather than investigated and mm-hmm. assisted. And that's what we see happening all too much. And you know, you can start waving the system flag and everything like that. And that's why I keep going back to talking about personal connection, personal responsibility, trying to do things on a one-on-one level where you can.
And I do think self-medication with substance abuse certainly becomes a huge factor, because if there's if a person is trying to self-medicate and treat their own mental illness, they become involved with illicit drugs, and the whole cycle starts.
Mm-hmm. Why do people with mental health issues, from depression and anxiety on up, have a tendency to become involved with illicit medications?
I think it is an attempt to feel better, mm-hmm. and to cope, to escape. Things
mm-hmm.
are too painful. They're not, you know, mm-hmm. they want to numb out.
Like you might want to take a beer to relax after the end of the day.
Well, mm-hmm. and if you look at our system, you can wait months to get an appointment, and then it's stacks of paperwork, and then you're disqualified, and then you're sent to another office, and then you have to wait longer. Uh-huh. You can just take your cell phone and call a drug dealer, and they'll make a house call.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I mean, I do uh-huh. think it's quicker, it's easier, it's
less
cheaper.
Stressful.
In some ways.
Yeah,
and
wow.
So,
good point. Coping mechanism. We only have a couple of minutes. Another point I wrote down is coping mechanisms. And when I think about coping mechanisms, I think of, oh, those are all good. But that's not necessarily true. There's some bad coping mechanisms, one of which we just got to talking about. So I haven't framed that. You want to mention about coping mechanisms?
Okay. Yeah. That's a big one, I think, a lot of people turn to. Another thing that Gwen talked about is promiscuity. She talked about that in the film, and as a way to cope with, you know, feeling very uncomfortable with her scars and her body. And of course, that puts people at another risk level of, you know, STDs and violence and many other kinds of things. So mm-hmm. That could be another possibility for a very unhealthy or dangerous coping strategy.
So where is Gwendolyn now? Where is she in her life?
She has a home. She is almost finished with her degree. Mm-hmm. She graduated in June in music education. She's still performing locally around town here and there.
Wow.
I believe she's in a relationship. I don't know how much I'm allowed to say.
Oh, okay.
but I would say that she's in an excellent place, mm-hmm. and it's slowly gotten better over mm-hmm. the 5 years. There'd be little fits and starts, a few steps forward and one back, and then a few more steps forward and then one back. But the trajectory has been up.
And I think a lot of that is because she chose to get help,
yes,
the kind of help that she needed. Certainly the film, I think, was a really positive step for her, and she's giving back, she's sharing, she's helping other people by telling her story, and she's getting the kinds of help that she needs and the kinds of support. She's accessing the resources in the community.
And I think Deb had a lot to do with that too. Strangely enough, all of her contact with the mental health system up until Deb became part of her world was medication only. And finally, for the first time, was it about a year and a half ago, she actually got to have some real talk therapy, which was pivotal in her understanding and her blossoming.
And that was through a referral that I was able to make.
All right, we're in our last minute. Mary, I'm going to let you summarize. I always like to say, what is it that we're trying to accomplish here today?
The platform for the film is that mental illness is not a character flaw, that it is a treatable condition. And I encourage people to reach out on a personal level to people around them, to not be afraid of mental illness, but to see it as an illness. And I'd also really like the opportunity to thank our generous sponsors for this project, because they're the silent heroes in this, the Rasmussen Foundation and the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority were large supporters, as well as Chicken and Egg Pictures and the Fledgling Fund out of New York. We could not have done this comprehensive project, including our outreach and our discussion manual, without the support of major organizations who are identifying, as we are, that we need to do awareness raising in the arena of mental health.
Okay. Deb Ward and Mary Kotsky, thanks very much for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next week, Line One's going to return. We're going to keep on the psychological aspects for one more week, and when my guest will be Daniela Schiller. She's a PhD psychologist and a researcher at New York University. We'll talk to her from NYU and discuss some recent research that I became aware of that she's doing that is very promising in helping people with anxiety. And I would mention that at least 10% of us out there have significant anxiety. So why don't you join us next week? Pat Yak is Vice President of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line One, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.